The Tom Woods Show, episode 2113.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm sharing with you today an interview I did about 5 years ago with a visitor to the Mises Institute, and I'm sorry I don't recall his name, but he was asking me about, well, I thought a whole bunch of interesting questions that might repay a revisit here. A lot of them are fundamentals of libertarianism, but not all of them, and yet once in a while we can stand to revisit those fundamentals, can't we? And I think you might appreciate some of my answers. So I'm just going to leave it at that. I think this is around, might have been 6 years ago, 2016, or maybe 2015, 2016, something like that is when I gave this interview. So we're going to be covering a bunch of fun topics, and I hope you enjoy them. Here we go.
Tom Woods, thank you for being with us.
I'm very happy to do it.
I was surprised. I was looking about you on internet, and I found something on Wikipedia that was interesting.
I have a stupid entry on Wikipedia. It has nothing to do with my life at all.
There are Tom Woods laws.
Oh, gee, yeah. I don't even remember my own laws.
I'll tell you, and you can tell me if that is true or not. The first one says, whenever the private sector introduces an innovation that makes the poor better off than they would have been without it, or that offers benefits or terms that no one else is prepared to offer them, someone, in the name of helping the poor, will go for curbing or abolishing it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. And the second one is actually shorter, but sharper. The progressive left always prefer a neoconservative to an anti-war libertarian.
Yeah, they say they feel more comfortable with the so-called neoconservatives because, by and large, they look at the world the same way, that the world needs to be managed by smart people. And they believe that the system we have now may need some improvements, but it's basically correct to have a centralized state with a large welfare state and a big military presence. But the libertarian is so at odds with all this that the fact that the progressive might have the anti-war position in common with them is not enough to make the libertarian not be radioactive for them.
Back to the Mises Institute, it was actually founded in 1982, but I wasn't able to find out how long had you been a senior fellow of the Institute?
Well, in 1982, I was 10 years old, so okay. I was not a senior fellow at that time. But I believe it's been 10 years since I've been named a senior fellow.
In all your story of the Mises Institute, can you tell us what is the Mises Institute's goals in the society?
Well, I would say it's twofold. The really specific goal is to train up a generation of economists who can really understand what's going on in the world and prevent some of the economic catastrophes that we've seen just even in recent years. And in particular, we want to train people in a particular school of thought, the Austrian School of Economics. It can boast many geniuses, many great minds, and it has a lot to tell us today. So we want to place professors who believe in this in universities. But the more broad and general goal is to reach not just academics, but the general public and teach them about a free society, how it works economically, but also how it works socially, and how our whole worldview is consistent. It's a worldview based on the idea that each person owns himself and the property that he justly acquires. Nobody may invade anyone else's property or person, or otherwise they have to be punished and make restitution. And that on the basis of these simple principles, the result is a society of tremendous wealth and opportunity and very high standard of living.
Great. In these 30 years of the probably more than 30 years of the Mises Institute, have you noticed any change in the society? Have you noticed the influence of the Mises Institute?
Little by little, yes. I mean, just today, Walter Block at one of his talks was saying that back in 1966, if you were to ask how many, in fact, he did ask Murray Rothbard, who helped to found the Mises Institute, how many libertarians are there in the world? And in the entire world, there were, in Rothbard's estimation, 25 libertarians. Now, it's true that Austrian economics and libertarianism are not the same thing, but they are at the very least friendly cousins, we might say. And today, there are many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of libertarians. I think the Mises Institute has played a tremendous role, especially since the internet was created. The Institute has been such a benefactor to mankind, these great classic works that are so intellectually exciting, that teach that what you've been taught in school about how terrible it would be if wise experts weren't overseeing everything. You learn how society really can run itself. It's very exciting. And anyone anywhere in the world can read any of these books or take any of these courses or listen to these lectures and hear some of these interviews. It's that when I talk to people and I say, how did you first get to know about these ideas, over and over again, it's the Mises Institute, the Mises Institute, the Mises Institute. And today, it's true, not every economics department, but in a lot of economics departments in American universities, if you are an Austrian so-called economist, they oftentimes view that as an interesting addition to the department. They don't say, well, there's no chance we'll hire you. We have professors being hired all over the country, and that was not happening before the Mises Institute, period. That was not happening.
How has it changed that the attendance of the Mises University in the last 30 years? Because in this year, it's like it's 30th birthday of the Mises University. Has it changed? Do we have more kids and young people coming to the Mises University?
That's a good question. That I personally don't know. I'm sure the people who run the Institute would know. I can say, though, that as somebody who went to the Mises University as a student 23 years ago, and I think back on it, I would say there are more students today. But I would also say the students we have today are also qualitatively different. It's not just a different quantity of students, but they're better students. And the reason, again, is that because of the internet, they can read this material, they can master this material, and they can show up here wanting then just to become advanced students. They don't show up as complete beginners, knowing nothing, and we need to teach from there. We have a lot of students who know an enormous amount just when they walk through that door.
They already come with a background of libertarian ideas and outside economic knowledge.
Yeah, so we couldn't be happier. And I've been talking to the faculty this week, and they're all saying to each other, this is such an exciting bunch of students because they know a lot, they're curious, they love learning. We have an optional exam at the end of the week. Now, these kids are already coming to an academic week-long conference in the middle of the summer, and they don't have to take the exam. The room was packed full of people who wanted to take that exam. Now, I should point out, in all fairness, that if you pass the exam and you move on to the oral exam portion, and you do very well there, and you move to the final oral exam, you do have the chance to win a cash prize. So there is a chance that that is also a motivation.
That could be. Before I started the interview, I asked in Chile about two libertarians if they wanted to make any question to you. And some people actually asked me for some question. There is a guy called Agustin Calderon who asked what I think is a very basic question, but it's essential to understand, especially in Chile where the movement is not very unknown. And the question is this. The libertarian movement in Chile is still small and very unknown. A basic but important question is, what does a libertarian defend? A free market that is commonly known with buying and selling goods and services, or an ethic of self-possession?
Ah, okay. So in other words, the question is, most of our countrymen are not libertarians or maybe don't even know what libertarianism is.
Yeah.
So if I want to approach them and I want to increase our numbers, how should I be explaining it? What should be the fundamental principle that I want to convey? Is that what he's saying?
What does a libertarian defend? The market, the possession of a person? What is?
Well, I would say the market really is secondary. The market follows from the first principles. So the first principles, it's true there are libertarians with differences of opinion on this, but to me, the first principle is the idea of self-ownership. And the idea ownership of any property means that you can use it as you see fit, as long as you don't harm anybody else. So if I own these glasses, I am the one who decides, you know, when they go on my face, and nobody else makes that decision. Well, likewise, if I own myself, then I decide the things I'm going to do. Or if I want to donate a kidney, that's my decision. People can't come up and say, well, that poor guy could use a kidney, so we're going to start grabbing it from you. These would be my decisions. And so when I begin there, everything else libertarianism believes follows from that. A free market follows from that, because in the free market, we have everybody owning himself and making decisions about how he wants to interact with other people, what kind of labor contract he wants to enter into, what kind of products he wants to produce or consume or buy or sell. But it ultimately goes down to this question of who owns you. I mean, if you really, really want to get people thinking, because they never think of issues like this, the question might be, who owns you? And they want to say, well, I own myself. But then they also want to say, but if the government wants to send me off to fight a war, it can do that. Well, then who owns you? That's the question.
Or if you can get married with a person of the same sex or different sex.
The question is, who, again, it's just who owns you? Who can be making decisions for you is where it, and then, by the way, from there, of course, a lot of people are worried that they say, that sounds very nice. And superficially, that sounds like a good idea. Everybody owns himself. No one can tell anybody else what to do. But they say, but the poor will be neglected and we'll have all this impoverishment. And that's a whole other question. But I will say that if you look in the world at the poor and you say, where in the world are the poor doing the best? Where are they suffering the fewest deprivations? And it's always in the countries that have the most capitalism, always and everywhere. The most economically free countries also have a poor population that is suffering the least in terms of material goods. I don't think that's a coincidence, and I can explain why it's not a coincidence, but the point is, you shouldn't fear that the poor won't be cared for. You should be glad to know that under this system, they will enjoy material comfort at a level that the greatest kings of Europe did not enjoy.
Did you say in the beginning of the interview, in your second law, I believe, that the left doesn't like the libertarian movement at all? But actually, the conservatives as well have problem with the libertarian. Yeah. Why is that? Why are they afraid of the freedom?
Yeah, okay. I have a little bit of sympathy and a lot of frustration with conservatives because I came from that tradition. So when I hear them talk, I can hear my old self talking.
Me too.
Oh, my goodness. Of course, as you know, they are willing to accept some libertarian ideas, and they say they like
free market.
Right. They like private property. They realize that private property can be a conservative thing, but they feel that, and I don't want to make it sound like these are frivolous or stupid people, because they're not. A lot. I mean, some of them are, but some of them are very smart people I've learned a lot from, and they feel like if there isn't some kind of authority, let's say giving moral guidance to people or something, that society is going to degenerate morally, and that when it degenerates morally, you can't have a free market. You'll have a bunch of dissolute people who are just seeking physical pleasure, and they just don't think you can have a society based on that. But my answer to that is, well, I also believe in moral principles, but it does not follow that the state has to be the institution that inculcates moral principles in people. Why can't it be families or your church or your personal philosophy or whatever it is? But why do they automatically assume it has to be the state? And secondly, it seems to me to be the case that once a people becomes morally degenerate in some way, or they're lazy bums or whatever, it never seems like politics is ever able to change that. If you want to change the moral standing of a people, you have to go about it some other way. You have to go about it through education, moral exhortation, whatever. But passing a law doesn't do anything. It doesn't accomplish anything. And even when I think about abortion, abortion's a controversial issue among libertarians, and there are a lot of conservatives who are against abortion, some libertarians who are against abortion. But as Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute has said, whatever your position on abortion is, if you think about all the tens of millions of dollars, maybe more than that, of dollars that conservatives have spent fighting for pro-life politicians who are going to stop abortion, and they've accomplished nothing, absolutely not one thing in 40 years, nothing. What if they had taken that money and devoted it to helping young mothers and donating resources to young mothers who would like to have that baby, but they don't know what to do, and help them find employment? And that would have had such an immeasurably better effect. And
there are a million ways to use that money in a better way.
Exactly. And so I would say to conservatives that you have been scammed by people. You've been scammed by slick politicians, by think tanks that are urging you to send money, and you send the money and nothing ever changes except you get a more insistent letter asking you to send more money. Think about what you can accomplish outside of government, because government hasn't given you a darn thing. Think about what the ordinary operation of society can yield you. What if you just try voluntary methods? So there's that. But also, look, I'm an extremely, well, in English, we say I'm an extremely square person, by which we mean I don't use drugs. I don't, you know, I drive a minivan with my five kids in it. Very conservative in that way. But I'm still a libertarian.
Conservative.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But I think of myself as a conservative in that way. But I still don't support the state because I feel like the state undermines me at every turn. It's implicitly forcing my kids to be educated in principles I don't agree with. It's undermining me through taxation. It's making my life difficult in various ways. If I could just have my nice little community and make my own decisions about my family and what they're taught and everything, that would be everything a conservative could possibly ask for. But I think some of the conservatives feel like we need to shape people up with the state. And I would say, look, if you can have a family, an extended family, a community that you feel like is a good, comfortable place to live in, be thankful for that and be content with that. Don't try to change people in San Francisco. Write articles if you want to, but just fix up your own family, your own neighborhood, and be happy with your little plot of ground on this earth. And that is all you can expect in this life.
Hey, everybody, let's take just a minute to remind you that there are so many things that people can struggle with, like anxiety and depression and stress and relationship issues, and they afflict us for so long and so regularly that we come to assume that this is just part of life, that there's nothing we can do about this. This is just our fate. In fact, we're so caught in it that the very question of whether it could be avoided, whether there's anything that could be done about it, sometimes doesn't even cross our minds. Well, Woods is here to tell you that there is help in the form of our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will figure out exactly what it is you need, match you up with a licensed professional therapist who specializes in what you need. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. You can check out the ton of testimonials on their website. And by the way, just in case they don't fix you up with your perfect therapeutic match, they'll get you another one. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/woods.
Another person on Facebook called Paulo Mulier asked me, why we lost the battle after the end of the fall of the Berlin Wall? If it's supposed to be a one for us.
Yeah, I think the answer would be that people drew the wrong lesson. They drew the lesson that central planning may not work, but the Western style of still a lot of government and some free market, but sometimes very heavily regulated and with a heavy welfare state, this is the better way to go. So they did not think of it as liberty versus tyranny. They thought of it as tyranny versus a middle-of-the-road system. And I think they believe the middle-of-the-road system succeeded.
Let's move a little bit to American politics. What do you think of Gary Johnson? I made you this question before, but I wanted to ask you here.
Well, I mean, there are worse politicians than Gary Johnson, but I find him to be, and I have been a supporter of Gary Johnson. I've not voted for him in the past, but I've said good things about him, and those can be found online. But I guess this year I became impatient with him because I thought he does have a great opportunity to get attention this year, and yet he's still as boring as ever. I mean, he's had 4 years to improve his style, to learn more about libertarianism, not to get trapped so easily by trick questions, to be ready for the tough questions. I don't get that sense with him at all. I think he's a very much an intellectual lightweight. He's unimpressive. And for him to go around saying that libertarianism takes the best from these people and the best from those people, and we'll bring them together. No, these people are terrible, awful, horrible people, and so are these. We have nothing to do with them at all. And especially in a year when people are so angry with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, they are angry. And he's saying that Hillary Clinton has been a wonderful public servant. Those were his words, a wonderful public servant. And we're going to take the best of both. I would say to the contrary, look, if you're angry, how are you going to get what you want by voting for the same people? You know?
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm not half like this group and half like that group. I'm 100% the opposite of all of them. Okay? And you may say, oh, that's a little bit too radical for me. But you know what? Has anything else worked? Why don't you give this a try? Give me 4 years, and if you hate me, I'll never talk to you again. You know, I would just be bold and upfront with people. So I don't like this whole wimpy, we're going to govern a little bit better, and government solutions don't always work as well. Yeah, people are past that.
We have the Republican and the Democrats, and we have Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any difference, really?
I actually do think there is some difference, especially this year. I mean, I think the key difference that you'd see would, even though it's obviously hard to predict what Donald Trump will do because we can't get him to tell us, or when he does tell us, 3 days later, he tells us the opposite. So I can't even figure it out. I mean, I cannot figure out his foreign policy. On the one hand, he says, you know, Libya was a mistake and we shouldn't do nation building. And on the other hand, he recommends crazy neoconservative books on foreign policy. So I can't figure him out. But I would say that the Supreme Court choices would be very different. I think Hillary Clinton would probably pick pretty hard left people on the Supreme Court, whereas Trump has actually submitted some names. He said, these are the names I would draw from. And he went to the Federalist Society, which is a conservative libertarian legal association, and he asked them for some names, and he put them out. And I do think the Supreme Court is important. But what would be in common with them is that really, they both seem to have this view that society really needs a strong man running it, issuing orders, issuing commands, directing production, directing trade, ordering people around.
In one word, a dictator.
Yeah, I mean, if not quite a dictator, then certainly somebody who doesn't share our view that society has certain built-in ways of ordering itself. They believe that society is all chaos until the great legislator or the great executor is in charge. And that, of course, is a big, big problem. And they would have differences on health care, but Trump would still favor a substantial government involvement. They both want the minimum wage increased, except Trump thinks the states should do it and Hillary thinks the federal government should do it. This is what we're fighting over? I mean, they have some differences on trade. I think that's no denying that Hillary has favored these trade deals that Trump is opposed to. And I think they have a major difference on immigration. I don't think there's any denying that. Normally, there's no difference on immigration between the Republicans and the Democrats. So for Trump to be nominated, there is actually a difference on that. But other than that, beneath the surface, I think with Trump, it would be a lot of improvisation. Well, I kind of feel we should do this, so let's do this. He doesn't want to put himself in an ideological straitjacket where he says, I have to favor liberty all the time. He says, I'm a common sense conservative. And common sense means, frankly, I'm going to make it up as I go along.
Whatever looks better, I take it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's what it is.
I have seen you and Congressman Ron Paul and Rand Paul on Congress talking about and questioning the Fed about how it destroyed Americans' money and how it monopolized all the currencies that Americans use. That's something I have never seen in my country.
Mm.
Isn't it been worthy? Have you seen any change in the rest of the congressmen and American people?
Well, I mean, there are congressmen now who want to ask questions of the Fed, serious questions, and that is very much a change. We have books coming out, not just from the Mises Institute, about ending the Fed. On my own show, I interviewed recently John Tamney. He runs realclearmarkets.com. Well, that's a pretty sizable site. And he's an Austrian fellow traveler, I would say, or maybe if not an Austrian. But he's not in the Mises Institute circles. He just wrote a book on, you know, it's called something like Who Needs the Fed? So that did not happen before. And also in the TV news and in financial commentaries, you see people who are absolutely opposed to the Fed who want to abolish it being asked for their opinion. That did not exist before. That was not an opinion that was featured in the TV news or in the newspapers. So, you know, this is going to take a long time, but what Ron Paul did was take an issue that had been sitting there for nearly 100 years, which had never been the source of partisan argument, and suddenly cracked it open to the point where people grudgingly acknowledge that there is another group of people out there who aren't just arguing about what the Fed's policy should be. They're arguing about whether there should be a Fed policy. That's a huge contribution for basically one person to make.
Do you think is it worth it to have libertarians in Congress?
I have friends who disagree with me on this. I think it's a good thing. I think it's very hard to get a good one who stays good. But I think the reason you want them there is that if they're not there, people will look at the people who are there and say, well, this must be the range of options I have. I have the right-wing interventionists and the left-wing interventionists. I guess I better choose. If there's a libertarian, even one, who is saying no to this, it lets them understand that there are more options. And most people do not learn political philosophy by reading books. They learn it by reading in the newspaper about the elections. And if we're not a voice in those elections, how are they ever going to hear about us?
All of this about the Fed and how it destroyed American money comes mainly, I understand, from the Austrian School of Economics. Can you explain what is the difference between the Austrian School from the mainstream?
Well, they would not deny that if the Fed were to create an awful lot of money under certain circumstances, that it would raise consumer prices and this would be undesirable. They don't dispute that. But the Austrian criticism goes well beyond the point about consumer prices, because there can be times when the Fed is doing things we disapprove of. It's expanding credit and the money supply, and consumer prices do not rise. In the 1920s, the Fed did these things, and consumer prices did not rise. And the forerunners of the, well, let's say like early Chicago people, the forerunners of the mature Chicago school, like Irving Fisher, said that the economy's fine. The Fed's doing a great job. The price level is stable. But what that concealed, the micro effects of what the Fed was doing. First of all, prices should have been falling in the 1920s. They stayed stable. But the problem is that the Fed's manipulation of money and credit sends ripples through the economy, and it changes the kinds of decisions entrepreneurs make when they look at how easy or difficult it is to borrow money. This affects the kinds of projects they undertake, because the longer your project, the more the interest rate is important to it. Because, you know, obviously, if you have a 30-year mortgage on your house and the interest rate goes down by even a fraction of a percentage point, that has a big effect on your monthly payment. If you had a one-month mortgage, you wouldn't even notice the difference. So the longer your project, the more sensitive it is to interest rates. So when interest rates are pushed down by the Fed, it makes entrepreneurs engage in longer-term projects. But it turns out that these projects are not really what society wants or needs at that time. The general public is not prepared to save the resources necessary to complete them all. So it gets the economy on what seems to be a prosperous track. But eventually, now obviously you need a little bit more time to flesh this out, but eventually the economy catches up with all this, says, wait, this is all fake. This is not how these resources should be arranged. And then you get the recession, which is where the economy says, look, these resources really belong over here. And this project should be abandoned completely. So this is what we talk about, the Austrians. And you don't see that with the Keynesians. And so this is why we were saying there's going to be something going on related to housing and other stuff in the 2000s because of all the pushing interest rates artificially low.
Could you give us some words of encouragement for all of the libertarians in Chile who try to increase the movement and all those entrepreneurs who are trying to fight against all these laws and regulations that just stop everything?
All right. Well, you guys are all the great heroes of civilization, and you won't be told that by people who should tell you that, but I'm telling you, you're the great heroes. And I would say, first of all, you know, we have these great tools, YouTube, social media. We have to think of ways to be clever, funny, grab people's attention. But I would say that in Chile, it sounds to me like the libertarian movement is where the American libertarian movement was in the late 1960s. And it seemed hopeless and there were so few. But look where we are now. We have millions, 2 million people voted for Ron Paul in 2012. even though most of the people who wanted to vote for him were not registered Republicans, so they couldn't vote for him. So millions more support him. And he was a guy who was saying the opposite of everything they'd ever been taught in school. So it's very hard. It's easy for Bernie Sanders to get votes. Bernie Sanders is the socialist guy running in the U.S. It's easy for him to get a lot of votes because he's just saying what they all learned in school. Ron was saying the opposite of what they learned in school. And he was saying it in the most in-your-face way imaginable. And millions of people supported him. We now have millions of libertarians. So what will be the Chilean libertarian moment? I don't know, but I hope to be able to see it.
Dr. Tom, I don't want to take more of your time. Thanks a lot for your time, and I hope I can interview again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to that. Now, tomorrow, I've got Todd Zwicky from the law school at George Mason University. It's the Scalia Law School, so that tells you a little something. And he became a bit of an international star when he sued the university because he said he had natural immunity and he should not be subject to this vaccine mandate. And since then, he has just become a veritable lion on this whole subject of COVID and mandates. And I wanted to revisit his story and talk about what he's up to now. So that's going to be a great episode. I hope you join me for that. And if you like and appreciate what goes on here at the Tom Woods Show, become a supporting listener. You become part of the cream of the crop, the salt of the earth, by heading over to supportinglisteners.com. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.